somewhere out there in any number of sources over any wonderful tradition of storytelling, whether it be oral or written, there's a story. And what we'll do this weekend is I will tell you stories that are both deeply familiar to the tradition and ones that I guarantee that since I've never found them in a written form particularly anywhere, and I know, trust me, the kind of Joe Friday scholarship on this subject. Does everyone know what I mean by that? I mean, I'm a professional academic. So if you went looking for this material in every, you know, in the Wiener Zeitschrift für der Süd- und East-Asien, I have read those articles, right? Like that's an old, crazy German journal. You see what I mean? Like, I know this the way physicists know physics. Does that make sense? Like, I was trained to do it in the small table with the pros. So, and I'm telling you that one of the more fascinating features of these stories is how few of them are actually in the public provenance. That you have to, you got to know a guy who knows a guy, who knows a woman usually, who knows another woman, because they have the stories. And I was lucky that way. I went to India as a very young man. I stayed a very long time, much to my mother's chagrin, my Italian mother. Did not like the idea and was so freaked. I never really quite had the nerve to tell her what I was really doing. But when she passed, I found a stack. I used to send her postcards that said, having a wonderful time, wish you were here. And I wrote them from everywhere, like the Taj Mahal, a snake charmer, like anything I could find. But I always wrote the same thing. She goes, I know you had a wonderful time, and I know you wish I was there, but what did you do? And the answer is, I just had a wonderful time. I'm not really going to tell you. But the storytelling tradition is what my teacher used to call the long way home. And it really begins with the idea that the stories themselves speak to values and to issues that they as stories are reaching into worlds in order to retrieve them. So in other words, there isn't just a story out there. There are things about the story that are what we might call what's really at stake. And that the story becomes a vehicle to get to these important issues of our individuality, of our experience as embodied beings, as natural beings, like how we are, like what the world does to us, what the natural world does to us, what society and culture and history do to us, and then in the formulation of our own conscience, our own character, in the formulation of our own individuation and self-actualization. So the stories, in a certain way, begin also in a place that it's not unfair to think of them as having, for lack of a better term, and this can be kind of misleading sometimes, but they have a kind of a Jungian origin. And that's also because, without a doubt, Jung is ripping this stuff off. It's not the other way around. Okay, so most Jungian theory really comes through his adventures through dreams and mythologies and visual images and other sorts of content. And he knew, like we all know, that what makes the Indian case so interesting. And right now I'm teaching a class at the university called Comparative Mythologies, and it's really great, good fun, like it just couldn't be more fun. And I get to do, again, I've been there so long that no one kind of wants to wake the dragon, so they all let the sleeping dog lie, which means I kind of get to do whatever I want. No one really wants, like, why would we get that guy mad at me? Like, because you're not going to change my mind anyway. Like, I'm going to do what I want anyway. So, but the idea of using that privilege or that possibility is to pay it forward in an interesting way. So I get to do things like spend 3 months reading Beowulf in Old English just to figure it out, like because I have the time, because that's what I can, because I know how to do that. A couple years ago, I taught Iliad and Odyssey in the same course I taught Mahabharata and the Ramayana, that is the Greeks and the Indians at the same time. And to really blow their minds, I told them on day one that I was going to act as if you had read all four and knew them well. Because the comparative, because if I had to wait 15 weeks to get all the way through it, it's going to be a no-fun zone. Like, we're not going to really learn anything unless I dazzle you, confuse you, overwhelm you, complicate the matter. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. By referring to all four of these epics of, you know, voluminous content and nuance all at the same time for comparative purposes, but the saving grace of that is the same saving grace of these stories. And that is that they actually begin with the idea that the story is a vessel. The story is a container. And what's in the container are issues that essentially turn three ways on our human experience. They turn to us, again, as natural beings. And in that sense, they mean to, let's use a fancy history of religions term, they mean to de-anthropomorphize the argument. That is to say, they mean to place our human concern at the same level as any other natural concern. That is, they don't privilege us as human beings. They say, look, here you are, it's a natural world, you're an embodied being with respect to plants and animals and weather and the planet. Like, you're here. And in certain ways, we are simply a facet of the jewel of life itself. We're kind of a piece of a bigger story, but we're not the center of the story. And that's an important kind of Jungian distinction, because it also pushes back against some of our own predilections, and this is all just category one, because of our presumptions of the historical providence and legacy of our own religious traditions. You have to remember, our Genesis story begins with the idea that no matter how you look at it, we come on day six, and the whole gig, in a certain way, is there for us. And Augustine points to that early on in Christian literature. It's called the argument from design. By the 19th century, this becomes a big deal, because it's always kind of filtered through the Christian lens that God has a plan, we're part of the plan, and we're here as, in some sense, as stewards of the plan. Like, it's a little enigmatic about what the plan is and how we figure it out and what we're supposed to do. But in a certain way, and they got to figure that out, like burning bushes and prophecies and incarnating the Son and then speaking to other prophets and law. They got all kinds of shtick to figure out how to get that thing that's out there back into this world. But in all of those cases, it puts us, in some sense, in a privileged and centerpiece version of that world. And the first premise of these stories is, don't start there. Start with the idea that, like all other things, what almost everything else is doing, we're just doing in a slightly different way. You're almost better off thinking in Darwinian terms. We're simply part of a process in which evolution doesn't make us superior, it just selects us in a peculiar way. To dissuade yourself of natural world superiority, like, my favorite nature of the last 2 years was a program called Owl Power. It's like an hour or 30, I can't remember how long it was. But owls are superior beings in almost every possible way. Like, not only superior to other birds, you leave that going, damn, how come I have to be this? I'd be way more badass if I were an owl. Like, it's like, and Sanskrit literature really loves them too. They call them the assassins of the night. And just as another feature of the way language also works into these strange and wonderful stories, one of the things that marks these stories is, are their sources? And we'll talk more about where the stories come from too, because that's kind of what we're talking about now. Like, where do the stories really originate? And the answer is the unconscious. The answer is they originate in the places of our invention. And the first premise of a Hindu world, and you don't have to think you're Hindu or not to think this, because none of this pertains to that. Because precisely the point is, these aren't Hindu stories. These are stories that originate in a place that is so primal, it's so deep and archaic in some sense. It's such a natural phenomenon that all the stories are going to do is give shape and form and articulation to them. Much of that happens in language, and we'll talk more about that, because our character is a character who, in some sense, is charged to turn things into language. One of the features of these languages is that the stories really come from multiple complex sources, that is, what's going to fill the container, is marked by history and culture and language and resource. And those resources are diverse in lots of interesting ways. When they're closest to us, they originate in languages that are close to us. And here you get a kind of another indicator of the strange way in which the unconscious and the subconscious does its business. So, to make this clearer, one of the strains of resources that are going to be for these into these languages come from languages that we call Indic, which of course obviously takes you to the word India, right? But they refer to languages whose origins are some 4,000 miles to the west of there, somewhere in the eastern Ukraine, about 5,000 years before the Christian era, about 2,000 years before they arrive in India. And those peoples back there went east and west. They ended up as far west as the Ire and Ireland, right? As the Iran in Irania, in Iran, and as Aryavarta in India. This is all the same word. Right? So the word for the Irish is the same word the Indians used to describe their place. And now it's not a reference to ethnicity, it's a reference to tribe. It's kind of a word that means us. This is, of course, the exact same word that German National Socialism procures in the middle of the 20th century and misuses and abuses and fucks it up forever because we can't use that word anymore. That's the word Aryan, right? But that's the word that the Irish are using for themselves. The word Iranian, right? You know that the Anian ending there, that Eonian ending? Like if you were from my neighborhood, the town next door is called Hackensack, so you would be a Hackensackian, right? That actually is another grammatical feature of these language groups. So part of what infiltrates strangely into our unconscious and subconscious is that we are hearing sounds and we are being taken on a journey that even as it begins to come to the surface from the unconscious, already smacks of mildly, strangely familiar things. Am I getting anywhere? So for example, the Sanskrit word, does anyone know the Sanskrit word for owl? It's owl. And you can't make this shit up. I mean, I'm going to say that to you 1,000 times this weekend, but let me say this. If I were making this up, how good would that make me? Yes.
I'm Hungarian, and I find so many of the old Hungarian words are same in Sanskrit.
Okay, now those are borrowed words. Mm-hmm. So because Hungarian, which is the Magyar language, is actually more closely related to Finnish, which is closely related to those languages we call Samian. So they belong to a different migratory group. And interestingly, the Hungarians sit as what we call an isolate language, much like the Basque do over on the other side. And part of our stories come from this migratory tradition, where you're going to hear a lot of strange familiarity in the number. I'm going to ask you to do something in 1 second to show us the difference. So let me count to 10 in any what we call Indo-European language, and you will hear the sounds. Like 10 in Sanskrit is eka, dwi, trika, chatur, pancha, shashta, sapta,
ashtanga. No,
Ashta, Nava,
okay.
Dasa.
Okay.
Dasa as in decimate, as in 10,
yeah, three,
right? Chatur is a good one, right? Because chatur will take you to cuatro, mm-hmm. or to four. You hear how it goes? So somewhere in your subconscious, somewhere in your unconscious, you're already checking that box. Mm-hmm. Could you count to us for 10 in Hungarian? Yeah, it's not related. It's not related. Numbers aren't related. I'll do it for you in Tamil. Tamil's the Dravidian language, which is another resource for our stories, a very important one. It's It sounds like 30 million butterflies fighting in Valhalla and having sex at the same time. Like I don't know what it sounds like, but it doesn't sound like anything that's familiar. But the unconscious registers things from sources that we don't know. That's why it's so much easier to learn an Indo-European language. Like, I could take you to North India, and we could mess around in Hindi in 3 weeks. Now, not only is Hindi really easy, like as languages go, it's really easy. But it's also like somewhere in your subconscious reaching into your unconscious, you're going to hear it. Whereas I know people who have lived in Tamil country, lived there 40 years, still can't speak a word. Because it's wired in a different way. And this is also what we call them mosaic languages and isolates. So let me just give you a little hint here. We're not going to get off these kinds of subjects because I'm not only interested in languages, I'm interested in language, which is really a very different thing. And that's crucial to our Ganesha stories because he is, in some sense, the representative of what it's going to take to bring the unconscious into actualization. How do we get from, and the premise of the story being the Hindu premise that I didn't even tell you before, is that before we make it, it makes us. So let me do that in an interesting way so you can see an important historical contrast in case you ever kind of go down the path of the history of religions and want to think about this more. It's a glib overgeneralization, but let's make it. Buddhist thinking originates in the idea that consciousness invents the world. And so they lean deeply into what we would call the subjectification of consciousness. That is, the world you experience is your experience of the world. And the Buddhists are going to lean very far into the idea that the world as such is a construct. It's an invention of consciousness. And so they're going to argue, and which is incredibly smart, and pause on the Buddhists for a second. If we were all rational, if we were all Vulcans and we were looking for an earthly religion, we would all be Buddhists. The interesting thing is we're not. But we would be, if religions were arguments, we would be Buddhists. And the history of Buddhism in India becomes a history of recruiting some of the best and the brightest who are startlingly brilliant. Like, you study Buddhist philosophy whether you agree with them or not, just to be in the smart room. There are some really brilliant writers and thinkers, and they are really brilliant. But part of what they're also arguing is that bees have a bee world, and whales have a whale world, and humans have a human world, because there is no world. There's consciousness experiencing the world. Does everybody see the distinction? Now, the Hindus come along, and they don't refute this, because Hindus never have to refute anything. They just have to do like the Star Trek Borg. It's like, resistance is futile. You will be assimilated. So all they have to do, which is really what happens to Buddhism in India. Like, Buddhism doesn't die in India. It just gets absorbed. It just gets taken over. And it gets taken over because they don't have to reject the idea that your world is made of experience. They just have to argue that the world that you're making made you. So they're arguing that there's an experience that made your experience. Now, they're not going to have to argue there's a God or there's an agency or there's someone or something that did it. Some Hindus will do that because some of them want that theism. But what they will argue is that no matter how you're inventing the world invented you. And it invented you on its terms, without your consent, without your permission, without your input, without anything, you got here. And it's also going to kind of assign, and this is interesting, a concept of grace to that idea. My teacher used to say, I said to him once, what's grace? And Upa said, you didn't earn it, you didn't deserve it, and you can't pay it back.
Love that.
Right? And what he mean, and you didn't earn it, you didn't deserve it, and you can't pay it back. And that's why responding to acts of grace are so interesting, because we want to think we deserved it. We want to pay it back. We want to think we can turn this into a transaction or into a reciprocity, and we really can't. Like, it really is a gift. And the hardest, it's a lot easier to give a gift than it is to receive a gift, because a gift really given is really an act of grace, at which point you can go, thank you. But you didn't earn it, you didn't deserve it, and you can't pay it back. Because if it's any one of those things, it's not really the fine-honed definition of grace. It's really a lot closer to a deal. Now, it can be a perfectly legitimate, lovely, wonderful deal, but it's a deal. It's a transaction rather than an act of, one might say, offering unadulterated by anything else, by any tincture of. That's why writing a thank you card is a graceful thing to do, but expecting a thank you card means it wasn't grace. Yeah. See how it goes? Mm-hmm. So So we can offer grace back, like we can say thank you, or we can do the right thing, such as it is, but that's a test of character, not of transaction, which is another thing we ought to think about in our current age, because we are testing character. And character, you'll notice, is not ideologically bound. Right? You can have vastly different convictions and still think that a person has integrity because they have character. You can agree with someone's ideology but think that they don't have character. You can dispute somebody's ideology because they don't have character. Okay? So it's a complicated set of categories as soon as we begin to think about it. Because that's part of what our story is. Our Ganesha wants you to know that every time you think you got this licked or the world is simple, think again. Right? Because part of what is so fantastic, especially about this instinctual character who begins as a natural being, is that we come from an instinctual presence that is in some sense way long before we learn things. It's already happening. And so there's much in these Ganesha stories that will point us, for example, to the great Steven Pinker's book that's called The Language Instinct. A little 411 on that. This is a great, because it's an important idea for us. Pinker argues that we actually don't learn language from our parents. That's one of the first claims of the book. Because language is an instinct and not merely a learned project. Because we're not learning it by mimicking our parents, because of the kinds of mistakes we make when we're little in language, like we mistake nominatives for accusatives, as like she and her, things like that, all the time. And if we were mimicking, and this is one of the examples I love about Pinker, he says, if we were mimicking, then why don't we sit quietly on airplanes? Our parents do. You know, so we're not really doing that. The argument is we have an instinct that arises and is kind of cured and cultivated in an environment. That environment is usually familial. It's usually why we think we speak like our parents. But we're not learning from our parents. We're honing skills and abilities that are already built into us. That's the kind of the first premise of his argument, and which means that it isn't an acquisition. It's a feature of our being as such. And whether we acquire, and then the second thing he notes, and this is a very important feature of it, and one we should never underestimate, especially in our own environment, and with the kind of strange and important dialectical diversities that we experience as Americans, is this, and that is that the way someone speaks in their peculiarity of their dialect or their syntax or other kinds of things is not an indication either of their intelligence or their sophistication. So that when we begin with the idea that there's a standard or normative English, like there's a way we ought to speak or there's a correct way to speak, this is itself a political act of some interest to us. Not because there isn't such a standard, but because that standard does not reflect either intelligence or sophistication. How do we know this? We know this because there are American dialects that are not standard English, where in fact the level of nuance in the sentence is much more complicated than standard English is. Do you want me to give you an example?
Yes.
Okay. So if I said to you, I'm working, that could mean I'm at work, or it could mean I have a job. But if in standard Black American English I said, I be working, that would mean I'm at work, not I have a job. Right? So, or it's the other way around. But because I might be misunderstanding the dialect. But the dialect adds a level of nuance that our ordinary, that standard English does not. And to someone in the dialect, that's perfectly clear. And that's a distinction you would want to make. Now, we can show that in all kinds of other languages. So to mistake the correct way for either the more intelligent or the sophisticated way is actually a mistake. It's a more nuanced feature than that. And it can be hard to convey this to folks, either because they think that they're in the superior position, or just to give you an interesting example, because I noted it on the way over here, my oldest and best friend in Rochester is a carpenter I met like the second week I was there, who I've known now these many 30-odd years, whose second son is named after me. I love this guy. And he speaks he speaks a local. He speaks a dialect. And he often apologizes for the way he speaks in front of me. Like he goes, you know, I'm not educated. And I said, but you're missing the point, Ron. You're no less intelligent or sophisticated. You were just cured in this environment. Like this is just how you learned to speak. Right? So because and at a certain point, and this is going to be interesting in the Ganesha stories, we that hardens up. That's why it's so much harder to learn a language when you're older, right? Because it isn't that the instinct goes away, it's that the wiring just starts to set itself. And it becomes much harder to learn because you're baked. And the baking process is real. And then as the baking process starts to wither, which we're all kind of experiencing, right? That's another set of different issues. But Ganesha's first kind of important storytelling point is that we come from something that is informing us in ways we don't even know. See, it's coming from an unconscious. It's coming from a subconscious. It's like counting to 10. And if I taught you, I'll promise you this. If we spent the weekend learning to count to 10 in Hindi and in Tamil, you'd get Hindi like that. Because it's going to sound like something you know how to sound out, even though you don't even know you're doing that. So the entire foundation of this storytelling tradition is very Hindu in the sense of it not being Buddhist, because it isn't telling you you're inventing the world. It's telling you that with and without your consent, the world is inventing you.
But language and culture changes with time. Mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm.
Hang on, because okay. This is only the first of three ways in which the story tells us.
Okay.
The story tells us that it's instinctual at the core and unconscious in its being.
And is that like that doesn't change?
Mm-mm.
Okay.
And that is going to be very important because it's also going to be able to say when we look across culture and through history, human beings have been able to wonder about other human beings. So there's the great...
When you said Appa told you that it's not the 16th century anymore when you're reading the old
Right, things. Right. So, but you're ahead of the game here, so be okay. Patient with me for just 1 second. So the core, but the core here of core memory is that the idea that in core memory, it's the elementals are human. They're not Indian, they're not Norse, they're not Irish, they're human. And of course, Jung's archetypes begin there in the claim that what's coming through is coming from this unclaimable resource. That it's really there, and that it has to arrive in a vessel and take shape in one form or another. And that, again, his most important point is that it's going to take the long way home to get from this dark and inchoate natural instinctual resource of the unconscious. By the time it does reach us, it's already been sifted, panned, broken up, disturbed, and that's why he's going to talk about myth and dreams in the same kinds of ways. Because think about it, and he always encouraged us to write down our dreams. Why? Because you know that if you had a dream last night, how quickly it evaporates, like how you can't hold on to it. And the entire kind of medical theory here that's now translating into language and memory theory is that by the time you try to retrieve it, you're only getting bits and fragments and tiny pieces of it. So the question is the first claim is the unconscious is trying to break into you. And it does so in the long way home. And what's the long way home? This is going to be myth, art, music, anything that kind of like gets inside your being and works you from the inside out and somehow just like makes you rock and soul. Like the way your dashboard vibrated when the Beach Boys came on. Like it wasn't just the words and the music, it was the whole damn dashboard vibrated. And you're just going, God, those love good vibrations, they were for reals, okay? Because that's what he was talking about. He's talking about something that's much more vibratory and original in our nature. And the first claim is that it's breaking into us. But what artistry does, poetry, music, storytelling, is it's trying to break into it. And we do it every day, Jung says, because we dream. And we fantasize. And we invent. and the greatest achievements, as Keats would call it, the imagination with a capital I. I don't know. It was kind of an early 19th century affectation to use a lot of capital letters in English. Probably actually comes from German nouns. But that's another weird feature of history. But what we're really saying is, you know, Keats used the word imagination as this very distinctive quality of human creativity, because we're trying to break into the feature of our consciousness that is, by definition, unconscious, as Jung called it. Like, you really can't, like, you can't get there directly. Now, pause here, because we need this important distinction, because we need it. You're very, and we'll go fast through this material, because I think you're sophisticated, because it's a sophisticated room for sure. And the point really begins with, notice that we almost only use the word myth pejoratively. We almost always use it to dismiss or to relegate, to condescend, to we use it not only for fiction, which we know can be moving and important. We use it to dismiss, we use it to distinguish it from fact, from reality.
It's just a myth.
It's just a myth. Mm-hmm. Or we're going to dispel the myth.
Yeah.
Right? So notice, too, that with and without our consent, we are being conditioned and inured to definitions. Whether we're, like, I can point this out, and we'll still do it. We'll still hear it on the daily news, right? And we must never underestimate, and this is kind of getting to Mo's second point, how socialized we are into the ways we think about things. Because those two...
Mythbusters.
Right,
to the truth.
Right.
Yeah.
But we want to bust myths, but for the other reason. If we can bust into a myth and get a myth to bust into us, then it can do something magical. Like, in other words, it'll feel magical the way Asimov thought. Asimov said all good technology looks magical, right? And what he meant was, if we know what we're doing, then taking the indirect way, right? So the simplest way to think of this, just to pull a distinction out for use, is that a fact is the shortest distance between two ideas, and a myth is the long way around. Facts are verified, myths are interpreted. Facts are asking, but I walk into worlds of facts all the time. I walk into blackboards that do this. They're big funnels. Because it wants to say all this shit over here equals all this stuff over here, and the big equations get smaller and smaller. And then when you finally come to the bottom, you'll notice that it's still trying to tell you something. Because the thing on the left side that equals the thing on the right side is not the same thing. It isn't saying A equals A. That's what we call a tautology, right? It's saying this thing over here equals that thing? Well, what does that mean? Like, what are they the same thing? Or what do we mean by equivalence here? Like, that seems to be self-evident in the math classroom that kind of evaporates in my head. You're looking at a narrative when you look at an equation on the board. Mostly we're illiterate. We don't know how to read it, which is why we find it so daunting, right? We can't follow the connections, which is why we have a t-shirt that says religion in classics, because math is hard. I am. Or would you like fries with that? Don't get me going. But my point really is here that we use the word myth, right, to mean untruth. And in fact, we use it to mean manipulated, misused, false, right? None of which we would necessarily associate with, say, Jane Austen. We think, what a story about human truisms, right? In other words, we've been taught fiction has value, but we lost the category of myth. The reason we lost the category of myth, I probably have a theory, so we won't go too far here, is that we've conflated it with facts. Let me rub a few people the wrong way. As soon as we say he really rose from the dead, as soon as that can't be a story, that has to be like, it really happened, and then a whole part of your brain goes, the dead don't get up. Or it would be really good if the dead didn't get up. Or we could have whole TV shows about the dead getting up, and that would be really bad. Because then they would be the walking dead, and that would suck, right? And I remember sitting in church going, zombie Jesus, night of the living, WTF, right? This ended up not being a good insight to me. Like, I'm going, stay dead, right? To say nothing of the incredulity and the way it simply flies, because And in fact, what they are saying is this one thing happened to him and won't happen to you until later. Sure. That's kind of the way they want to tell their story. But it really, but they are conflating the dead get up with your whole sensibility that that's exactly what they don't do. The distinctive feature of the dead is that they stay that way. Okay? And as soon as you defy people's credulity. And notice what, and notice here, this is an interesting thing just about Christians too. Notice they want this, they make a whole centuries, almost four full centuries worth of argument about how this only happened once. Now, most of us by now understand that things that only happen once don't happen twice, which is the definition of what false is. A thing that can't happen twice didn't happen once. Now, it could be that the algorithm is so huge you can't get it to happen again exactly the same way, but you can get it like close enough for rock and roll. Like that's what you yell at the guitar player across the stage before guitar tuners. When I was a kid, when you played rock and roll, the guitar player was always the most annoying person. Because even more than the front man, the lead singer, and more annoying than the drummers, who always go home first and leave you to pack up their shit. Okay. Do I know why the piano player is always the best player in the band? Because he goes home alone and has to take care of the drummer, and everybody else is already split. But the guitar player would turn around in tune for 10 minutes. And I'm sitting on the other side of the stage, and finally I just go, close enough for rock and roll. Like, just play louder. No one's going to know. Like, E. Yeah, okay, like, close enough, right? So there are things you can't get exactly right. Like, think of waves touching the beach. No two waves will ever touch exactly the same place twice. Why? Not because it can't happen, but because the unlikelihood of it happening is far greater than the likelihood of it happening. That's actually a really important concept as we go forward. That's called stochastic, which is usually translated random, but it doesn't mean random. It means there are too many possibilities for the same thing to happen twice. Get it? But close enough, you'd go, yep, that last wave looked a lot like this last wave. You see, like, you go close enough. And then we go close enough for rock and roll. If you're a base spring training, this is also called the neighborhood play. Does anyone know what that means? Oh, come on, somebody else. Do we have to know what that, do we need to go to there? Okay, ground, less than two outs, ground ball to first, ground ball to the infield, toss to the shortstop or the second baseman. Guy's coming down from first base, right? He's going to go flying into this guy. No one wants to die. Has everybody got that? No one wants to die. He's going to slide in, spikes up, death, right? Toss to the infielder. Infielder does not touch the base, right? Jumps up in the air, makes the throw to first. Umpire calls them both out. However, the rules say you had to have touched the bag, right? Infielder never touched the bag. Why? Because no one wants death.
Yeah.
Get it? No one wants death to happen. So you go, that's called the neighborhood play. He's out because he was in the neighborhood. Get it? And the neighborhood was so outlandish, like he's so far out, that it doesn't matter. You get it? So you're working on all of this idea of how near is near enough. When is an approximation good enough? When is a resemblance close enough to know what one is? You see, like, how do you, like, and you know, our brains do this all the time. Like if we do it with birds, because how many of us know how many millions of species of birds there are? We just go, that's a bird. Because you're going, looks like a bird to me. You're not going, you know, well, that's actually the other kind of cormorant. You know, like, you've got to be like a birder to do that. Your brain doesn't do that. Your brain goes, close enough for rock and roll. Get it? Because it looks like a bird. Fuck yeah, right? So we formulate worlds. Here's kind of the important point that we rest at. We formulate worlds because of the way the world is formulating our impressions, our thoughts. The second feature of our instinct is that it is learned. It is, before it's learned, before our parents, it's conditioned. It's already being informed, not simply by our natural being, but category two, by society, by culture, by history. It's structurally informed.
In our DNA?
No. In the provenance of history itself. Max Weber, may I utter the name, Karl Marx, may I utter, Emil Durkheim. The argument is society makes us. Here's the simplest piece of the argument. We think we're individuals. Individuals are made by the societies that invent the idea of an individual. In other words, it's Florida. You didn't have to come clothed. You did, right? Because you did. Like, the naked cowboy in Times Square is a thing nowadays. I have a hashtag, Rajonica Naked Cowboy, just to see if anybody's paying attention. And I think that's funny, right? But the point is that we are already told who we can be. So our first category is an interrogation of who we are. The natural world made us, and it makes us from unseen things. The unseen is infiltrating into the seen. And the clever among us make art and poetry and storytelling and music to try to get over that threshold, to try to get to our sources, our core, our sensibilities of what lies lurking inside us. And what and as a footnote, what lies inside us that lurks there is everything. The things that are the scariest and the worst things, and the things that are most wondrous and beautiful. The light and the shadow cohabit the unconscious, and the darkness inhabits the unconscious too. Now, some are going to make an argument that there's good at the bottom. Like, say, there's the Confucian tradition that comes through Mencius argues that when any of us see a child fall in a well, we all have the same visceral, empathetic response. And exactly right. And he argues that to be human would be to have that response. And so we all have it, because he argues no one is immune from that response. All you would need is one exception. All you would need is one person who just doesn't give a fuck. Like, it can't be. Now, you could call that pathological, but there are enough of those people who have survived to mean that that's true. Right? So one can argue that part of what the Ganesha myth wants us to know is that at the core of our being, there really are monsters. But there are also really wonderful things too. But, I mean, that's where the Sigourney Weaver thing is so interesting. Like, the alien monster is such an interesting thing in the world, like while we're on to monsters. And our God here, Ganesha, is going to be often mistaken for a monster. Because we think of him as this cute, sort of sweet guy with the elephant ears, and how kindly and genteel, and, you know, he rides a mouse, and what a good fellow he is. And all of that's kind of true. But he's actually a deformed character. And much of the myth treats him as a monster. Or other people see him and think him a monster, because he's kind of scary looking. Because, you know, like, he's scary. He can be scary. We'll get to some really interesting, scary Ganesha stories. So, but go back to Alien for a second for two good reasons. The first is that part of the myth of that, it's an intention to make a myth. And the reason it worked so well, not just because it franchised well, is for two reasons. The first is that the monster is really a monster. Like, it has only one object, and that is to make you food in the most sort of dreadful way you could be food. So it works on predator, it works on pestilence, it works on pathogen, right? Because it emerges out of poor John Hurt's guts. It emerges, it covers every category of monster, seen and unseen. Because it also plants its seed in you, and you don't even know it's there. And then this thing emerges from you. So it's like a virus. So it's like a pathogen. It's like an unseen thing that gets you, which is kind of like an agricultural-based societal monster. Remember, when people started making grasses and growing, living in civilization, they died of different things. Itinerant, migrating, sojourning people die mostly from predation. They die from wolves or attacks or they end up in the wrong place or in a storm. They die from things that are extrinsic from them or things they can't control. People who live in society die from things that they're making of themselves. You want a really interesting piece of natural selection history about that? The history of lice is the history of human clothing. So there are two species of lice. One lives in your hair and the other lives in clothing. They can't live outside your clothing. So we know how long people have worn clothes by the history of lice.
Oh, nice.
Isn't that interesting? but this is a Ganesha story, because you see how weird and indirect and how much you didn't want to know that fact? Because it's kind of creepy, and who wants to know that fact? But Ganesha wants you to know that everything is the long way around. You get it? Like, to know one thing, you might have to know something else that you don't even think is related to that. Like, in other words, the broken path, the missing path, the extra piece, These are all crucial features of getting where you think you want to go. Isn't that wonderfully strange? So we know when people started to wear clothing because we know when this, because you can trace genetically when the species self-divided. But people live in, but the way people survive, the way they have relationship, the way they have sex, the way they have food, and the way they have death, that's the way in. And when people do, and when human beings have domesticated and they start eating plants and living in bigger groups and there's a lot more calories around, which means there can be a lot more people, right? They die of different things. They mostly begin to die from things they can't see. They die from pathogens and pestilence that they can't see. Whereas hunter-gatherers rarely die like that because part of human migration is we spent most of our humanity hunting and gathering, which is why we migrated, because you can't sustain a hunting and gathering culture with probably more than 150 or 200 people at a time. It's kind of geographically not possible. Doesn't matter how much forest you live in. You have to break into smaller groups. Are we having any fun with this? Mm-hmm. But all of these are Ganesha stories because they're all telling us how we have to put ourselves together from a world that puts us together in a very strange, indirect way. So we are culturally and historically conditioned before we begin to ask ourselves, how did that happen? Let me give you a really, I like to use this experiment because I didn't realize how distinctive it was, but I was raised in the first town in America that willfully and gleefully enforced the busing act of 1965. So I showed up in first or second grade, and they integrated the schools. And our town did this on purpose. Like, they wanted to do this. This wasn't George Wallace, this was the other people. And so I grew up thinking it was perfectly normal to have this enormously diverse community around me. Because they were not only like my close neighbors, we all went to school together. So we all like, we did everything together. We even had race wars together, even though we were integrated. Like, we did everything together. I didn't find out till I went to like the white Aryan Nation College in elitist liberal arts place in New England, that's not how other people were raised, you know? Leaving aside where I then went to college, which was like the worst place you could possibly go, because just think of that one kid who was preternaturally weird that you went to high school with and they all went to Harvard. Okay, now think of a whole place made like that. And you just go, oh fuck, how did I get here? Like, anyway. The issue is that we're made by forces we don't control, we don't consent to, and we're encultured in those with or without our consent. So let me go further into my own story just to make that point. My parents weren't on the super liberal, open-ended part of that integration argument when I was a kid. They just weren't. They were kind of okay with it and kind of not okay with it because they were reared in what we might call ordinary American bigotry. Like our ordinary ancestral bigotries. Let's be honest about those. They're just there. And they kind of had to get with the program because of who we're bringing home and how we're going to school. They were kind of forced to change in a certain way their values and ideas as they went along. But I'm definitely a creature of that world. And because I think I was raised in that world without my consent, without my understanding of the experiment that they were laying on us. But we are all social experiments, full stop. So our socialization isn't simply what we do with it, it's what's done to us. And again, see how that comes from not us, like we're not inventing that, it's inventing us. That's the Hindu proclivity rather than the Buddhist one. The Buddhist one would say, if you want to change the world, like be the, when Gandhi says be the change you want to see in the world, that's a Jain Buddhist idea, that is not a Hindu idea. The Hindu idea is the only reason you can change the world is because the world's giving you a way in to do it, which exactly describes satyagraha and ahimsa and all the theory that Gandhi uses, because if Gandhi didn't have the Brits on the other end of that argument, they'd have just been annihilated. Like, there are people like who go to nonviolence, because that's the argument at the beginning of the Gita, leaving aside the nihilism of the bad guys at the beginning of the Gita, is that if the villains are really villainous, they're just going to kill you. They don't care, like, oh, we'll all be okay in the long run. I'll do this joke. It's not really that funny. But you know the free Tibet bumper sticker? That's because the Chinese know it's free. Because they will not be stopped. Like, that is not an argument that nonviolence is going to solve. You might not want to be violent for other reasons. That might be your ideology. That might be your thing. But don't underestimate the nihilism. Just don't. That's a basic view of how these worlds that we're entering work. Now, that means that the monsters are real. Oh, the second reason the alien is a good monster, or an interesting story, is that it's actually a heroine story. And we have almost none of those in the West. So she ends up like three movies later, kind of mothering the monster, like, and being a mother to other monsters. Like, she gives birth to them, and then she's gonna, but she has the, but if we map Ripley onto Draupadi and Sita and Damayanti and other stories in the Hindu tradition, even stories we can pull out of Ganesha, because he's going to have feminine characters. We have almost no heroine stories left in the West. Like, we get, what, three Marys in, like, a handful of lines? The patriarchy's pretty much eliminated them. We get a little bit in Lysistrata, some in the Orestades in the Greeks, but basically nothing. The Indians give us lots of instances. And one of the reasons Ripley is such an important character is because they not only got her right, they got her to heroine right, because heroines do things that aren't like heroes. Heroines are a distinctive category. So when the notion of the heroic feminizes, it works in, it, there's at least two things that make it really interesting. I want you just to think about this, because you see it in Mahabharata, particularly the great Indian epic. Ganesha's got a piece of that too. Heroes die for the cause, and it's important that they die for the cause. That's why the current Star Wars sequel is still fucked up, because until Luke dies, we can't really move on. Like, Joseph Campbell pointed this out. He wasn't wrong about this. He was wrong about a bunch of things, but not about this thing. Okay? The hero, like, it's like Achilles. He's got to die at the end. You never see Achilles die at the end of the Iliad, but you know he's got to die. Even Krishna dies at the end of the great Mahabharata. Heroes have to die, and you have to know that they die. Heroines have a much harder path. They have to survive. And worse, they will. So they will survive to endure all of the atrocity and indignity and horror, because they will mother the next generation. Because their job is fundamentally not just to birth it, but to nurture it, but to endure it. Now, a lot of people don't like this, but that's the fact, that as you trace these stories, what you find out is that women endure the tears and men women endure the rage and men sweat the rage. It's their job. Now, it's not women and men, so let's fix this also. It's just code. So when Ripley, like, turns on the monster and does this thing, does the poking thing, very spear-like, penetrative behavior, that's masculine-encoded hero. When Picard turns his back and protects and runs away to fight another day or endure the pain, that's feminine encoded. Get how it goes? Mm-hmm. Masculine code puts up shields and spears. Feminine code does receptivity and self-generation. It can make and it can receive. Masculine code penetrates and puts up boundary. So instead of thinking of it as gender, think of it, and now we're really close to a good Ganesha story, because Ganesha is really the idea that we're made of what these traditions call sammelana. And sammelana happens when those two codes weave and blend together. Get it? They create a third thing. Like, we get cream in the coffee, and now it's a new thing. Because all of us are cream in the coffee, right? We're all made up of complex, complicated issues. And the other thing Ganesha wants us to see, something we see in Nataraja just as an image, it's slightly twisted and bent and over-encoded into this strange thing. I'm fond of telling this story, but when I first came home from India, I was gone a long time. I left when I was 19. I came home when I was 21, turning 22. And I brought my mother a little Nataraja, because our family tradition goes right back to that temple. Like, there is a Nataraja temple. Does everyone know that? There's a Nataraja in every studio. There's a Nataraja on every corner, like Santa Claus. Mm-hmm. But the real one is in Macy's. Right? So the real Nataraja is in this one place in India. Like, that's the real guy. My teacher's tradition originates in that place. My mother, in her last years, had Nataraja on her nightstand next to her Mary on the half shell and the candle that she lit for me every night, even though she wasn't Catholic anymore. She goes, "You know that little statue? I love her." And mom got it. Because the whole point is that, and the Ganesha character is this way. Like, it's a mixed up, muddled up, shook up world, except for Lola, and you're not Lola, okay? Right? We are a strange, weird, alchemical blend. And what appears as dominant on the surface, like you were born over-encoded female or over-encoded male, it's just a feature of the world not really actually working in balance. It works in a dynamic of shifting homeostasis all the time. Does that make sense? Like, we're not really 50-50 beings. We're always a little, as we see in Nataraja, we call it the krukti, we're always a little crooked. We're always a little tilted. We're always a little one way or another, and you adjust, and you're adjusting all the time. But you were made like a little more 51-49. You weren't really made 50-50. But that 49 in all of us is really there. That's why we don't gender code when we understand how this works. Because all of these stories are about the third rail. Facts make 1 and 1 2. Poetry makes 1 and 1 3. That's a simple way to think about it. That's why the myth is the long way around, because the myth is trying to get into the unconscious, and it's also trying to bring back something from the unconscious, which is what dreams, in some sense, automatically do. And you can't get to the unconscious with facts. You can't get there. You can use facts, but you can't get there with facts. I will explain why as we go along, because it's an interesting idea. So we're not proposing that we don't need a world of facts. Without the facts, we can't get the cell phone to go through the wall, right? And the cell phone does go through the wall. But with only facts, it won't matter whether the cell phone goes through the wall, because we won't have anything meaningful to say. So here's another one. This is a good one. This is hopefully take the top of your head off. I mean... Appa used to say, achievements and goals are substitutions for meaning. In other words, we like to have a box we can check. We like to have an achievement, and then we like to have a goal. But that lets us skip the idea, where is the meaning in that? In other words, you can achieve that and go, so what? Or should we have done that? Or is that a good idea? So we can make whole lists of goals and achievements without ever considering, why does that matter? Is that a good idea? What happens if we do that, right? So, I mean, you're kind of in a Truman post-Roosevelt problem. Like, we have this thing that can go kaboom. Should we use it? It's different than the fact that we can do it, right? So there are goals and achievements that still leave you with the idea, so what? Or is that a good idea? So there's nothing about a goal or an achievement that comes with meaning. Get it? And it's often used as a substitute or a postponement for meaning. This really upsets especially undergraduates, because they're inured to goals, right? Like, they think they should go there and get a goal. And then by the time they get to my class, like that one class in their senior year, they go, oh, shit, my life is meaningless. And then 1 second. And then I say to them, but that's the good news. Because if you think meaning is out there to get, you're making a mistake.
You're done.
You're done. Because meaning isn't out there. Meaning is something you're going to have to make the long way around, because you're going to have to make it rather than acquire it. Randall.
Something I keep thinking about as you're talking here, and this factual mode of consciousness and the mythic mode of consciousness.
Right.
Think about how does wit and a sense of humor relate to that? It's like,
exactly.
I just kept thinking, like, the people who are locked into that factual mode, you don't want them to tell you a joke.
Exactly.
Because it's like, to make that kind of leap of that lightning strike of the wit and the humor, it requires that kind of shift into the, you're in that factual mode, and suddenly you make this shift. Wait a minute, it's a mythic universe now.
Right, exactly.
That's where it's like,
or just think of Jon Stewart repeating the news back, except it's funny because of what my mother used to call that look on his face. There's that magical moment in the Bhagavad Gita where Arjuna has this huge meltdown, and the Sanskrit says smiva, which in Sanskrit means as it means either it means smiva. Smi is either to smile or to laugh, and you're never quite sure in Sanskrit. So it means as if smiling or as if laughing. And I came this close to translating it with that look on his face. Because that's kind of like what it means. Like Krishna, with that look on his face, then says... I thought it was a little too cultural particular to kind of get all the way across. I'm going to leave it for the commentary, where I will say it. But you're right, because, you know, Zhuangzi says, the great Chinese Taoist, he says, one laugh is worth 10,000 serious thoughts. And then unwittingly, David Hume, the great Scottish philosopher, says the same thing, like many years later. He said, for all of Kant's logic and reason, it don't make no difference. Because if you can get people to laugh with you, you can get them to listen to you. And it's the other pedagogical issue. That is, if you start a sentence, if somebody says something and you kind of think it's patently not correct, don't start with the word no, because they won't hear the next thing you say. It doesn't matter how right you are, right? So you're looking for a way in. And I think humor not only lets you in, it breaks you out. That's why the comedians are telling the truth, because it's the two rules of funny. There are two rules of funny? All funny things are true, but not all true things are funny. Okay, and the second rule of funny is to remember that in our paradigm of things learned and things encultured and things that we can change, that it's always a power paradigm. So you're never allowed to make fun of things that are less powerful than you. This means that all Dick Cheney jokes are funny. Okay? But other things aren't. So you're not allowed to pick on people who don't have your power or privilege. But you can pick on people who have your power and privilege. Get it? So, and that translates into a lot of things. Like, that helps you understand a lot of, say, like black comedian N-word humor. Because they're not violating second principle. They're not crossing a power boundary. And power boundaries are complicated things, like who has the power, who has the privilege, who has the ability, who doesn't, right? Those are judgment calls. But if you stay inside the two rules of funny, people will hear you. Because if you offend them but with power, they'll get defensive and they'll do those other kinds of things. If you don't tell the truth, they'll know you're full of shit. And that's not funny. So again, that look on his face, Krishna. But I think you're right. I think comedy is like art. It's like poetry. That's why it's interesting. That's why I do this gig, because I failed as a comedian and a musician. And
at the same time, the humor has to have that possibility or that kind of unconscious presence of grief and sadness.
Exactly. Because at the heart of our stories is a fundamental incongruity that changes everything once we see how it works in the Indian tradition. And that is, to love is to grieve. And that we love commensurate to the depth of our grief. Right? That's how you know you loved. Because otherwise you would grieve every day over the obituary page, and you kind of do, but you kind of don't. Get it? Because you know that other people loved. Right? But it may not be you. Please tell me. Oh, he's coming. He's really coming. Because he's going to be a character of grief. He's going to be a character of grief. Tim?
I was just thinking about when you were saying could and should, it made me think of something that in the software world now, like a question or a kind of a thought process is going around, is we're too busy, and I don't know where it comes from, but we're too busy asking if we could to think about asking if we should.
Right. And then you get ahead of yourself with what you could. Because all of this eventually redounds to individuality, which is going to be the heart of the Ganesha story. So let's start with some basic Ganesha stories, and let's not assume everyone knows the essentials, and then we'll go to the much more complicated stories as we go later on. Ganesha stories start in two ways. They start in birth and origin and sibling stories. They start in kind of, those are the ones everyone knows. And then they start in what we might call grown-up stories. The source of the Ganesha myth is a simple psychological phenomenon. He has a mother who wants to love him by suffocating him, and he's a father who wants to abandon him by taking his head off. So, and those are, we're going to consider perfectly normal. Those are perfectly normal places to start. So, because his mother doesn't really want to suffocate him, she just wants to love him, right? And so, and his father doesn't really want to abandon him or decapitate him, but he can't help it. So the premise of the story is that under the, and we're going to find out that he turns out in all of this ordinary dysfunction. Let's start out with the simple premise. We're all held too much or held too little, no matter how well we've been held or not. Okay. Whether we've had healthy parents or whether we've had abusive parents, we've all been held too much and held too little. Okay? Because we're all going to end up slightly akimbo under the best of circumstances. And this is the story of the akimbo child. He's going to end up happy, well-functioning. He's going to end up having the same grown-up problems we all have in an incredibly functional way, even though he's wearing an elephant's head, like even though he's deeply broken in some fundamental way. And part of what the myth does is it lets us exaggerate that in order to kind of retrieve its possibilities. Now, let's start out with a deeply mythic trope, and that is that Ganesha is usually understood to have been made in a physical form, either from the weavings of his mother's body, what's called her uchishta. So Parvati literally rubs off the substance that becomes the child and then infuses this image of a boy with her own life breath. And so it begins, and this is kind of important to understanding where Ganesha is in the history of Hindu thinking. It begins with the idea that the relationship between matter and its animation can be understood as having a distinction. And Indians are going to later argue about that. But basically, they want to argue that the material substance that makes him and his animation can be understood as two different kinds of things. That may not be true, and other Hindus later on will argue with that. But the basis of the story is there because the core of the story is that she either rubs him off, like her perfumes and her kumkum and her sandalwood paste and her sweat, and makes this child and then breathes life into the child. Or she laughs, like Randall got it. He's born of humor. And then he's going to, but it's not really humor and it's not really comic. It's that hasya, the comic in later Sanskrit lore, is understood to be sweetness, lighthearted. That is, that's what lightness of character is. It's being funny. So, because you can't be funny unless somebody feels safe, right? And you can't be funny, and the erotic looks predatory if you're not being funny. Does that make sense? If you're not really being funny. So it's a very careful line that they're drawing. Now, interestingly, the Tamils really understand this. Because the preferred name for Ganesha in Tamil is Pillayar. Like if you go to South India, he's called Pillayar. P-I-L-L-A-I-Y-A-R, Pillayar. Tamils generally don't, they'll call him Ganesh, they'll call him Ganapati, they'll call him by any one of these thousand and plus names that he has. But basically they're going to call him Pillayar. That's going to be the preferred name. The word Pillai in Tamil is the word for boy. It's the word for embodied human. The name Pillayar goes back to, is he made of laughter or is he made of substance? Because it's an inside joke in the Tamil language. So in when Shiva comes home, Shiva's going to come home to this creature that has been invented by his mother's parthenogenesis. So part of what's sitting behind this myth is a really important idea, and that is that Shiva doesn't need Shakti, and Shakti doesn't need Shiva, and she doesn't even need him to make this child. Now, the point of that myth is also that Shiva, the putative father of this child, who in some ways is the father but not the father because we don't have any exchange of fluids, we don't have any of that. There's no story in which she's impregnated. There's no story in which liquids are exchanged. We have to go to another god to find liquid exchanges and to find impregnation and other things. And that's going to get really even way weirder than this. Okay, and the reason I think this is the case is because what we're really marrying here isn't just to masculine to feminine, we're marrying Indic culture, peoples of the sky, to goddess cultures, people of the earth. We're marrying the stories of Sanskrit to the stories of Tamil people. We're marrying god culture to goddess culture. And the first principle of the Ganesha is that the goddess culture didn't need the god culture. The reason for that is the Tamils are there for 45,000 years, probably, before the Indic people arrive. The reason I say that without a flinch or exaggeration is that the Tamil genome bears more resemblance to Australian Aboriginals and to people in Papua New Guinea than it does to North Indians. So they're there as India breaks off from Africa and New Guinea goes this way and Australia goes that way. There are people in South India who have been there 65,000 years.
Do they look different?
Yes. They're Dravida. They have curly hair, much darker skin, flatter noses, and yes, you can tell Dravidian people. They don't look like North Indians. And North Indians are genetically related to people from the West. Mm-hmm. Those things that we found out about language 150 years ago that said that Sanskrit and the North Indian people are migrants because their languages descend from Sanskrit. So India, like Hindi is a daughter language of Sanskrit, which is a daughter language of the language we call Vedic, which is a daughter language of even older Indic languages. Okay, so all of that stuff came from the West. It migrated there about 2000 before the Christian era. Whereas these folks, deep in the jungle in South India, down there, they are cultivating grasses when the Chinese are. Like they come out of the Ice Age and essentially create civilization. Because they're not hunting, gathering, migratory cow people. They're domesticated animals, grass-growing village people. Those migratory people, their gods came from the sky. That's why Vedic gods come from the sky, and Sanskrit gods are masculine sky gods. Tamil gods are goddesses that come from the earth. They come like this. And there's literally older material that talks about the marriage of sky and earth, the marriage of heaven and earth. And what they're really, in a sense, talking about is the marriage of two very different cultures. That Tamil mother culture is there long before the Indic people, and those folks are so self-sufficient that their primal goddess doesn't need a man to make a god, doesn't need a man to make anything. And that's deep feminine code, because feminine code is generative. It can be receptive, but it doesn't have to penetrate to be generative. It's going to make itself. And so she makes this character herself. Now, part of the underlying purpose of the Ganesha myth is to make sure that we query, well, where is Shiva? Like, why is she doing this? Like, how come he's not at home? Now, that's going to take us to another story. And the simple point of the simple story that preludes the Ganesha story, it's really interesting to know, is called the dice game. So once upon a time, this is a very long story and I'm not going to tell. I'll tell it in like the 2-second version of it. The dice game story goes like this. Shiva and Parvati, who don't need each other but want each other, that being the beginnings of their intimacy story, because Ganesha is a story of their intimacy. Their intimacy begins when we don't need each other. This isn't a codependency. This is a co-desire. They make each other mental. They know that the other has something to offer to them. They want this, but they don't need it. And so a sage comes along and he kind of taunts them. And he says, well, we know that one thing you're good at. What about something else? And he says, if you gambled, you would find that interesting. But you wouldn't find it interesting to gamble with anybody else other than each other because everybody else would lose and you would be really good at it. And Shiva says, well, that would be true, but I would never lose. And then Parvati, the goddess, goes, nah-uh. Like, you want to play dice? I can win. And he goes, nah-uh. Right? And so basically they play a version of the dice game that's a kind of strip poker. And in the last very moment of the game, which is both, notice it has dice, so it has variables but unpredictable ones, so you're doing that stochastic thing, but it also has rules, which means you're inside a structure. So they're playing a very structured game, and the game they're also playing is a lot like cribbage. So it puts in pegs as you near the center, and the loser is going to end up with an extra piece. This is vital to the Ganesha story. The loser is going to end up Like you lose when you have the extra piece. It's like, it's like the opposite of musical chairs. Like you're supposed to not end up with the extra piece. So they're at the very last throw. Shiva is gonna win because Shiva's the house and he knows the rules. And if you just play the game long enough and play only by the rules and never ever break the rules, you'll likely win. It's not always, but you'll likely really win. He's about to really win, and at that last moment, she does this. Hey, baby. That's called lasya, L-A-S-Y-A. In a Sanskrit dictionary, that's called coquettish, charming. She gives him the A baby at the critical moment, and of course, he's snafu'd. Like, that takes him right out of persona. Like, that breaks him. It breaks him. You get it? And then she wins because his attention is broken. Now, go back to the Ganesha story in this entire metaphysic. His ability to pay attention, his ability to be in the rules, his ability to be the rules and win doing only one thing is emblematic of oneness. Get it? Her ability to break the rules and to reorient the world is her ability to be manyness. So metaphysically, this is the one in the many, and the many wins every time. Why? Now he goes, you cheated. And she goes, I got the goods and you want it. Right? So they have a fundamental argument about whether that was cheating or not. And the argument that the goddess tradition gives is, those are just her gifts. And by the way, if she didn't have those gifts, then he wouldn't want her anyway. Because he actually does want to be broken. He just didn't want to be broken this time. Get it? He does want to be broken into, but he never wants to admit that he's broken into. Now he's going to end up with a whole posse called the Gunas, who then see that he's left with, he goes, I didn't lose. She goes, look in your hand. And he's surrounded by his thugs, like his posse. These are called the Gunas of Ganapati, who go, no boss man, ain't nothing in your hand. Right? So we get all the paroxysms of denial. Bear with me. It's a Ganesha story. So he leaves in a huff. Now we know he's going to come back. He's going to come back for the same two things. He's going to come back for that other thing that they do well, like badgers in a barrel. And he's going to come back to play the game. So, because he wants revenge, because he wants to win, because somehow he knows he lost, because the evidence is in front of you. Now you're in a very Hindu world because the evidence is in front of you. A famous scholar once said, Hindus resort to the unseen only under duress. So they want their mysticism in evidence. You don't get to be like mystical and spooky. You get to be mystical if you can prove me, if you can show me. It's always show me the money. Hindus are always a show me the money culture. Like, you want to see the unconscious? We'll build temples. We'll give you 330 million gods and we'll tell you stories all day. Okay? But we're going to show you the unconscious. That's what a Hindu temple is. It's the theater of the unconscious. It's the theater of memory. Rand?
So could you say that Shiva is kind of playing the game 1 + 1 = 2.
Correct.
And then suddenly Parvati says, well, wait a minute.
Well, it's exactly what he does. Because he's playing the game. There's the dice. He's on it. So it's him in the game. Right? She interrupts the game. That's the third thing.
So her lasya does that.
Yes. Her lasya is the cause of the break, which is the cause of a reconnection. He has to reconnect with himself, which he fails to do. He has to connect with her to say she won, which he fails to do.
So he's playing the factual game.
Right. Because in the facts, 1 and 1 only makes 2. But in myth, 1 and 1 can make 3. Because the recursion doesn't happen perfectly. Like, there could be an interruption that you didn't anticipate. So he leaves. Now, she gets the joy of winning, which she has for about 30 seconds. And then she goes, wait a second, I just won. It's getting lonely around here.
He's gone.
Like, I like that rakish, lying, ruffian, denying, cribbage, stuck hand guy, peg guy. And so when the Ganesha story starts, it usually starts with, she's lonely. And the question is, why is she lonely? Well, in fact, she didn't start out lonely. She started out pretty happy that she won the game. Like, you know, like you said I couldn't win, and here I did win, and by the way, there's the evidence, and now you're gone, and I get to do what I want. But part of her creation of the pillai, the boy, is that notice right away. This is definitely a surrogate husband story. So the guy that she really wants, who she can't control, leaves. Right? And he's a pain in the ass. Has everybody got that part? Because he is. But she does create the husband that she could want if he were perfect. So you don't have to be Dr. Freud to figure out the next piece of this Ganesha story. Right? So she's going to get, and then where is she going to put him? She's going to put that child on the doorstep of what? Of her inner chambers. Not only because he's going to come home and want the booty, he's going to come home for a booty call and for to play the game again. Because those are the two reasons he left. Right? Like, you do these two things better than others. And the reason that's kind of interesting to just keep note of is that I'm making fun of it as the booty call, but it's an intimacy where they want each other. And that's an important part of this story, because in the end, these stories are either about intimacy or they're about liberation. You can't have it both ways. You either want something that gets you out of the malaise, you want something that gets you to a love that's beyond grief, let's call that liberation, or you want the love that is grief. I'm not going to much tell you the love beyond grief liberation story, mostly because I'm not interested in it. But I will tell you this. If you can liberate yourself from liberation, you learn to love again. Because you're no longer trying to get past the grief. You're no longer trying to work out the grief. You're no longer saying to yourself, I can get to something that isn't filled with grief. Because I don't think you will. I mean, I don't think you will. But good luck. I mean, if that's your path, go right ahead. But that's not where...
True liberation would include grief.
If you want to call it liberation, but that's not what the tradition calls it. The tradition calls liberation something unconditional. Mm-hmm. And grief is the condition of love. It's its shadow. But it might be its light. Get it? It might be its light, because once you turn on the light of grief, then love as its shadow becomes something wonderful, like you wouldn't want to be without it. All of us in this room are old enough to know this experience. We've all lost someone who we will never get over, get past, get through. The grief that we actuate and integrate and incorporate into our lives is the love. But we all wake up in the middle of the night crying for someone we've lost. Right? Like, how can we not? So that's kind of, but let me just give my prejudice in advance. That's the story I'm going to tell. We can tell the Ganesha story as a transcendent love story, meaning unconditional, where you actually expurgate everything except the love or except the liberation. And I suggest to you that that's not the one we're going to tell. Okay, so they want the intimacy because it's fun, because it's a good reason to be embodied, because, you know, who doesn't want the plumbing to work? For all the right reasons, they want the intimacy. But they also want the game. And the game is... And notice that the game that they play, the dice, and yoga folks don't necessarily like this, but it's a competitive game. And they both want to win. Because they like the challenge. They like the competition. You have to go to there's no competition on the yoga mat is to go to unconditional yoga. And that's not really what happens. Some way or another, you're competing with something. You can be competing with the idea, I'm not competing. Get it? But you're still competing. You can go, I'm not competing. That's a competition, right? It's like saying, I'm unconditional. I love you unconditionally. And I would say, that's an interesting condition. Right? Like, that's a very interesting condition, that no matter what you do, I'm going to love you. Right? Okay, that's a very interesting condition. It might be a core condition, right? Like, it might go all the way down to you can't help it and you're going to feel it anyway. But it's still a condition. Once it gets to the surface, it's still a condition. I won't digress. So the story in front of why does she make this child is the dice game. And the dice game is a story about how she can't win, how she's not capable, how she's not worthy. And then she creates this character, all of her own lonesome, like she doesn't need him to do it. I suggest to you that this is the old mother culture, the Aman culture, we call it in Tamil, the anima culture that Jung called it, the unconscious mother connection, coming to the front of the story. So this story is about how we long for that connection. Now, but instead of being expelled from the womb and cut from a cord, like us, that would be our first wound. Ganesha's first wound is going to be that he is invented without the understanding, right? Without the capacity to recognize more than his mother. He's too connected. He's too connected. Whereas our first wound is we were perfectly connected, and then we're given the gift of life by being separated. Hindu thinking is about crawling back into the womb. It's fundamentally Jungian. We're trying to remake the original connection. That's why walking into a Hindu shrine is walking into a womb. It's womb envy, and we want to get back. The problem is we don't really want to get back all the way to being completely reconnected again, not only because we can't be, but because that would be the problem with Ganesha, which is why he's going to wear his umbilical cord on his face. Get it? Because he's too connected. So whereas we suffer the first wound by being disconnected, it inverts the problem, basically. Okay. So Shiva comes home, and in Tamil, he says, Pillayarika. Pillayar is the name of him. Pillayarika means in Tamil, who is this kid? It's literally a contraction of the Tamil sentence. And because he can't recognize his own son, because he had no hand in it or anything else. So, incorrigible, really. So he's made, not born. But it's still a different way of experiencing what we call first wound. His father comes home, and like the utterly obedient child who has been told to protect, not to let anyone in without her permission. And then Parvati disappears to the interior, right? And what she has created, of course, is someone to protect her sexuality. Now, you could say that she's protecting her sexuality because Shiva is away, or she could say that she's protecting her sexuality because she's protecting it from Shiva. See, either way would be a legitimate argument. Like, you don't want the intruders to come. Like, Shiva's away, put the kid on the doorstep. He'll fight to the death, or he'll do whatever I say. And that keeps out the bad guys. So you can see it as intrusion and rape, but you can also see it as entitlement, as a form of the violation of intimacy. That Shiva will come home, feel entitled to the intimacy rather than the gift of intimacy, which is exactly what happens. Shiva comes home, tries to barge the doorstep, and says, "That's my place. I get to go in there." And the boy says, "Mom said no, no one goes." And he goes, "Mom?" but he's treating the gift of intimacy as his entitlement, as his privilege. I think that's much more the core of the story than her preventing the intruding rapist, because we have other stories where Shiva leaves her in order to address the intruding rapist. So there's a parallel story to this opening Ganesha story that makes sure you understand that wasn't the reason she creates the child. She doesn't create the child to protect her from anyone but Shiva. She creates Ganesha to protect her, the boy, to protect her from Shiva. Because we have another story. Trust me on that one. I'll tell you that story another day. But basically, Shiva, she's going to be raped by a demon, and Shiva says, "You got this." And he makes her fend for herself. And she goes into a cave, and she has to deal with this rapist demon, and Shiva never bails her out. And what he's saying is, and you can say that, well, that's cruel, and he could have helped, and where is Eden when we need him? But he's also saying, "You got this." Like, she's entitled, she's wholly self-empowered, which is why that boy can be created without her. And so these myths, these Shiva Shakti myths, these Shiva Parvati myths, begin with an autonomous masculine principle and an autonomous feminine principle, because the feminine is in the masculine and the masculine is in the feminine, and they don't need each other to make the third thing. They can make the third thing by themselves. So in fact, once they make the third thing by themselves, they're actually making another thing, an extra thing. He says, who's this boy? Boy won't let him across. This is the familiar Ganesha creation myth. Not everyone is all that familiar, so we just go through it quickly. And what is and literally he and Shiva doesn't act. He doesn't do anything. He sets the gunas, his posse, his mob, right, on the boy. Now, pause here because he is going to become Ganapati, right? So he's going to inherit the family business because the gunas are the family business. Right? And he's going to be firstborn because he's going to have three, maybe four, maybe two, maybe three brothers. By tomorrow, we're going to have to talk about them too because we can't get to the rest of the story without the larger family structure. We need to know a little bit about other characters, right? But the family business of the gunas are really peculiar because the gunas are not nice things. The gunas are pretty dangerous rabble. So in a sense, the gunas symbolically are all your wandering thoughts. They're all your feelings and stray things. They're all the rabble that's swirling around in your head and your heart. They're all the unaccountable and counting and myriad things that are rolling through your James Joycean stream of consciousness. All the things you're thinking about, you left the dog, you're worried, I'm hungry, I need to pee. Whatever it is, that's all that's circulating as an enormous rabble of streaming consciousness, those are the gunas of your experience. And he's going to become Ganapati, the lord of the rabble. And the rabble is every thought, every feeling, every subconscious inclination, every physiological response. My feet are cold, my hands are warm. It's winter in Florida. You're all cold at 50. The heat went on last night. I thought that was kind of amusing. I'm like, really? All right. It's all contextual. You see how they're really saying it's all contextual? Now, for Shiva to give away the gunas is actually a relief to him. So by the time we reach the end of the story, becoming the boss, Ganapati, and getting kind of the family business is actually Shiva being relieved of this horrible burden. Because the reason he has to keep the gunas close is that if you don't keep the rabble close, you can't find out who you are. He's not only he's protecting the world from the gunas, he's protecting the gunas from the world, but he's also keeping them close because if he doesn't, he's less integrated. He's all his own stray thoughts, not just who he thinks he is. So you're not only the I you think you are, you're all the I's you don't even know you are. Right? You're all these wandering things. As the gunas are literally decimated, go back to numbers, reduced to tens, reduced by tens, not eliminated, decimated, right? Shiva sees the danger, and that is that if this boy can do this to them, what can he do to me? This is when he raises the trident, the trishul, and instead of holding it up like a ruler, or down like a farmer to plow, he makes it horizontal like a weapon, he decapitates the boy. Now you have a clue, because the gunas are the boy is distracted. He's dealing with gunas. Shiva sees an opening, right? Because he fears for his own power, his own dominance in the argument. That if he can do this to the boys, he's going to get me. So before the boy can get him, while he's distracted, he decapitates the child. This is Shiva's lasya. Go back to the dice game. It's the moment of distraction. What does he use? He uses a power that he has. She used the yay baby thing in the dice game to distract the game. He sees the distraction and uses his trident, his weapon, because he has an opening too. So the instrument of decapitation falls back into the other story. Why? Because we all use the gift we need we want to bind things or break things, right? We want to open them up or we want to close them down. We want to go towards or we want to go away. We want to make this stick or we want to keep it apart. right? And this is the keeping apart part. Because, and why is that so extraordinary? Because the world is already unbinding us. Like, the world's dangerous, threatening, precarious, and messed up. Has everybody got that? Like, we're here, we need to break for lunch, like, soon, right? What time?
3:30.
Okay, great. So because if we, because holding ourselves together is precarious. So we're always holding ourselves together. That's why breaking ourselves apart is so strange. It's so much, like, it's lusia, it's weapon. It's the unordinary thing. The ordinary thing is to hold yourself together, which is to hold yourself in waking consciousness too, as the paradigm of reality. The whole model is built on don't fall apart. Get it? But unless we fall apart or break apart, we can't grow. We can't evolve. We can't change.
Do we really have a choice in that?
Not really, but we don't identify our gifts. Notice that her gift is identified as intrinsic. Her gift is the lusia. She is the charming thing, right? His gift is extrinsic. It's this weapon in his hand. Feminine code is intrinsic. Masculine code is extrinsic. Bear with me, because the Ganesha story kind of keep us on that story. So he kind of cheats to kill the kid, right? Because the boy is distracted, and he doesn't see it coming, and he's decapitated. Now, at the moment of decapitation, every version of the story tells us there is an eclipse. Does anyone know how an eclipse happens in Indian lore, Indian mythology? It's a good story.
Is that that Rahu case?
Yeah. So once upon a time, previously on 24, there was a demon who wanted to drink the soma, the elixir of the immortal. The elixir of the immortal, the soma, is also the moon, which is also the color of the immortal, because the moon is the color of sexual fluid and the color of death, cremation dust. But it's also the drink of the immortal because it's the reflection of the light of the sun. It's the digestible form of the gift of life. Because sunlight, luminescence, because here you are, you're awake. You're a living thing. You're a churn and urn, a burn and funk. JT. Right? But the way you churn and urn is you drink and you don't want to get desiccated, too burnt out. You want to hydrate. Right? That's the moon. So this demon wants to swallow the moon. Long story short, he's going to get decapitated. And he's going to have tasted a bit of the moon, but at the moment of decapitation. So every time he tries to swallow the moon, it comes out his backside, because he's got no body. Another, follow the heads. To follow the, Ganesha is just the most famous decapitation story. Every story in India, some way or another, leads to decapitation. Because you got to get this thing that isn't separate apart from this thing. And now we get a reunion story, because this, as you know, is going to get a new head. But there's an eclipse at the moment he's decapitated. This means that the demon Rahu sees it. He's witness to the events. Here's a part of the Ganesha story you've never heard. What happens to the baby head? Bear with me. Always, did you always wonder?
I did.
Great.
It bothered me greatly.
Good, we can fix that. But guess who sees the baby head? The demon, Rahu.
Oh, God.
Right. So while everybody else is distracted, Parvati's going to come out, have a meltdown, flip a wig, threaten him with no sex, plus I'll kill you for having what you did to my son, right? And Shiva's going to be in the mess of trying how to figure out this, what's going on. Nobody's paying attention to the wobbly baby head. Except who? Except the demon, right? Who witnesses it, and we know he's there because of the eclipse. That's a secret of the story. Every version of the story has an eclipse. That means the demon Rahu is there. That means the bad guys witness this. Now we're a little closer to figuring out what could happen to the missing baby head. Yeah, I promise we'll tell that before 3:30. So I'm going to hold you out on this. I got yelled at for not telling Ganesha stories. I'm going to hold out on this one too. Okay, so she comes out and says, what's with this? But in a certain way, and this is important to notice, she did create the child without conversation, commitment, or consent. No conversation, no commitment, no consent. That makes her creation of the Pillayar, of the boy, of the Ganesha, not exactly cool. Has everybody got that? This is going to come back in our story later. She's going to have payback. She's going to have to realize for herself that without commitment, consent, and conversation, this wasn't exactly, as we say in Jersey, Jake. This wasn't like all good. This was not cool. It's not all Jake. So she and the way she's going to get payback is a fantastic piece of Ganesha mythology because it's going to connect him to his brothers. That's the first piece of this. The next, so she comes out and they have this conversation. Now the better part of the Ganesha story also occurs here. Shiva, you remember, left in a tiff and in this kind of self-absorbed, near nihilistic narcissism, I didn't lose, I can't lose, I can't lose to you, but what about that thing in your hand thing? Right? He comes back, of course, and he's still got the thing in his hand because he can't get rid of it because it's the extra piece. Now, of course, realize that unless he loses the game previously, there's no universe. Because Shiva's oneness. So if Shiva's oneness and he's got an extra piece in his hand, the universe isn't one. It's one plus. Get it? So the next time Shiva wins the game, full on Armageddon. The universe stops happening. So in every breath, in every nano moment, Shiva is losing the dice game. Because unless he loses, diversity can't happen. Because literally there's more than one thing. There are two verses, diverse. So there's him, who's everything, na Shivam vidyate kvachit, the Tantra says, nothing exists which is not Shiva. But what you're really saying is, there's Shiva, and then there's this extra thing. Now he's got another extra thing, because there's this wandering head, he's got a stray body, and he's got a very angry wife, who, by the way, says, what do you mean? Like, this is my house, I should come home, this is the thing, right? And who's this kid, and how was I supposed to know? And then she goes, you cheated. And then he goes back to her, you cheated. That's how this whole thing started. So now they've got lots of things to argue about, but they have much to put back together. Are we sounding like a familiar intimacy story here yet? So Shiva finally does a smart thing. He asks for help. Which, by the way, in his oneness and in the expectation of him always having a yes man around him, right? Like, so he's got that cabinet, right? So he's not inclined to ask for help, but he does. Now, who he asks help from is important. He asks it from Brahma, Vishnu, and Indra. Brahma is grandpa in this story. He's called the grandfather in Sanskrit lore. And he is old masculine wisdom. And his MO is to take that extra piece of candy out of his pocket when your parents aren't looking and to cheat. So Brahma's MO is to give advantage when it's a little mischievous. And in other myths, Brahma is very good at giving boons or rewards to demons because he's not only there to give you like the extra little advantage because he likes you, he's there to make sure that you get the advantage if you earned it. So Brahma is like the spoiling grandpa who does nice things, but he's also the tenure committee. Like he doesn't have to like you to give you tenure. Which means that a lot of demons get a lot of rewards because demons do the work. And if the demons do the work, the gods can't stop them because the work is the work. In a Hindu universe, if you do what we call the tapas, if you do the effort, you get the result. Full stop. Goodness, there's no moral condition to being rewarded for having done the work. Another really important Hindu idea. You dissociate the moral character from the achievement. The achievement is the achievement, and it is not to be conflated or confused with goodness. You can do it or you can't do it. Full end of the story. Buddhists are going to moralize that. When the Gita moralizes that, like in the third and fourth chapter, it's looking more Buddhist. when he wants to equate good karma with good results and he means a moral paradigm, he's cheating. He doesn't mean that. The reason you know he doesn't mean that is that he doesn't want his warrior to think about the good. He wants his warrior to go kill these guys because he has to do it. Because you can't let the bad guys win, and it doesn't matter if it's right or wrong, they're just bad. Like, do your duty, stop asking moral questions. That's at the heart of the Gita's argument, right? Because your ability to do it or not to do it has nothing to do with whether it's right or wrong. That's a different question. We're not going to expunge moral character from the story. We're just going to separate it from achievements or goals. Your goal can be this guy has to die. That's how it goes. The purpose of this is pretty simple. We all have to figure out how to live with ourselves when we do things we know aren't right. That's a really important Ganesha takeaway, because we're all going to do things that aren't right, but we have to figure out how to live with ourselves knowing that we had to do it. Can I give you a little moral dilemma? It's a Ganesha dilemma. It's right in the middle of the same dilemma, because it's all like, how was this the right or the wrong thing to do? When 9/11 happened and my kids were young, but not too young not to know what was going on, I did a little, what did they call it in that era? Strategery. I was looking for the W word. Whereas I didn't tell them the whole story on the day it happened. The two little girls, and I made the parent choice to not like get all perfectly clear about the menace that's in the world. Because there is a menace in the world. And you know, I don't want little girls waking up in the middle of the night thinking that like people are going to fly planes into their house. So I did withhold a certain amount of the story. I let out the story in bits as we went along. Now, I could have wounded them by telling them the story. I could have wounded them by not telling them the story. Right? Like, isn't withholding just as problematic as telling them? That's exactly where we are in the Ganesha story. You're always making moral choices no matter what goals you achieve. But you can't know the moral choice the way you have to make the choice. You have to make the choice without knowing the moral consequence. There, that's the point. You have to make the choice without knowing the moral consequence. Like, was that the right thing or was that a good thing? But you still have to make the choice. Okay. So Shiva finally does a good thing. He gets Brahma involved. And Brahma makes sure that you understand that you can cheat a little. You can give candy before dinner. You can reward people you like, but you can't not reward people who do the work because they're going to do it anyway. So if you engage them, you keep a relationship. So Brahma has these complicated relationships with the demons, because unless you have a relationship with the demons, it's a bad thing. It's the same problem with the gunas. Unless you keep your gunas close, all those stray and wandering thoughts. See, most, like they're even teaching mindfulness now, which is really just a subspecies of Theravada Vipassana meditation, really. It's really not that complicated stuff. They want you to focus on one thing, the samadhi story. This is exactly the opposite story. If you're only thinking of one thing, you're abandoning all those other things you're thinking about, and they're going to come back and bite you in your butt. Bad time. You want lots of gunas going on at the same time. Oneness, thinking about only one thing, paying attention to one thing involves all those other things you're not thinking about. Careful. So this is a story about creating a much more complex nexus of integrated relationships in which that project of polytasking is ordinary. The goal is to be a lot of things at the same time, not just one thing. Because one thing can get you killed, right? Because you're not paying attention to the traffic. So you got to be paying. So you're not just multitasking, you're thinking of the world as complex rather than simple, which is a difference. Samadhi is a simple world, right? And this is a complex world. I always joke that by the time my world gets simple, I'll be hobbling down the hall wearing Velcro, calling somebody I don't know mama. So, not looking forward to that, okay? But you won't know, so it might not matter, right? All right, so he enlists Brahma, and now you see for why. Because Brahma is going to keep, Brahma's always being criticized for cutting such good deals with demons. But Brahma's argument is, until you're cutting deals with demons, you don't know what they're doing. Like, you'd better keep your adversaries close. Mm-hmm. Right? Point deux, that's French. That's what I'm making fun of myself. Vishnu, in our story, so he asks Vishnu. Vishnu is Parvati's brother. So he's Shiva's brother-in-law. And so he's going to be the maternal, he's going to be the boy's maternal uncle. In deep South India, maternal uncles are closer to their fathers than they are. Children are closer to their maternal uncles than they are to their father. Why? Because their maternal uncle is their mother's protector. Why? Because these are patrilocal cultures. That means that the girls go live in the husband's house. So literally, when a girl enters marriage, right, which is second wound part two, she is literally cut from her natal home and planted in this other home with a new husband. And who's her principal authority? Not her husband. Her mother-in-law. Her mother-in-law, who's the real boss, right? And her mother-in-law wants a son for her son, right? Because of all the patriarchy and patrilocality. Now, she will leave home to go back to her natal home to birth. That's why the Buddha isn't born at home in the palace. But it's also why, but the same custom carries out even in South India. So she gets to go home under certain kinds of peculiar circumstances, especially birth. That Parvati doesn't go to her parents' home to birth is another feature of her, in some sense, not following the protocol. Get it? We would expect her to have made this child not in her home with Shiva, because Shiva wouldn't go to her house. He waits for... The tradition is the girl... The bride goes home to birth in her natal home and comes back with the child. Like, he gets to fret and wring his hands some other place.
That also gives rise to the possibility of changes.
Oh, yeah.
If you're going home to your own family with this baby that no one's ever seen, there's a lot of...
Oh, there's a lot of... Oh, yes, yes, yes. Plus, there's this whole thing, who's really the daddy? So, which is a big deal in India, because who's your daddy is always a story in India. So, but Vishnu is there to make this sweet, because Vishnu is there, is allowed to be at his sister's birth. Because when Shiva marries Parvati, Vishnu comes up to Shiva like it's a big Greek wedding and says, "We love you, bro. I'll look after your kids. You take care of my sister. I'll look after your kids. Anything happens to you, I got the kids. Don't let anything happen to my sister, you hear me? Or I'll break your kneecaps," right? So, in my neighborhood. So there's this whole camaraderie, best friend, besties. The idea of the brother-in-law is to be the bestie, right? To protect his sister, but also because that guy wants to know what happens to his children. Because his sister has to be let go by the parents. The parents have to let go. Third wound is letting go of your children too, right? Like, you gotta let them go. They're gonna fly anyway, but they don't, in my mother's tradition, you don't let go. This is a Parvati problem with this Pilayar. You become a mamaluk, right? You know what that means? A mamaluk, it's an old Italian thing. It's you become a mama's boy because your mother won't let go of you. Now you get to Iron John, Iron Hans, Robert Bly, the Germanic story about stealing the key from underneath your mother's pillow. You get revolutionary boys who have to run away, right? Mothers don't know how to let go of their sons. Why? Because they got a surrogate husband who's even better, right? This beautiful, compliant, lovely thing. That's the boy on the doorstep, right? They find out that they want that, but they don't really want that because they want this other guy, but the other guy doesn't do what they want. It's a complicated thing. Right? So Vishnu enters the story to protect the child and protect his sister, but also to do his brother-in-law a solid, right? Because that's his job. His job is to create, and then maternal, you see how the maternal uncle creates this larger integrated, the family is naturally fragmented and broken because everybody has to go live somewhere. Like, everybody has to have, you're fighting the problem. You need your own autonomy. You need your own life, but you all want to stay connected. You're just working out that basic problem, right? The third character in the story is Indra. Indra is like coach or priest, but not the creepy kind. So his job is to be this kind of third masculine voice in the story. Now, the ordinary version of the creation story is that Shiva says to him, like the waves on the beaches, like the capricious interruption, take the head of the first creature you see, and it happens to be an elephant. Appa used to tell the story, my teacher used to tell the story, that said, sure, he said that, and everybody went, yeah, boss, we'll make sure it's not a duck. I'll do that one just for yucks, because this did turn up in the social media this week. The word Paramahamsa, which is used for great souls, the Hamsa is a migrating bird, and it's usually like, you're like supreme swan is the preferred translation. An actual Hamsa is a little brown-bellied duck that migrates across the Indian Ocean and the Arabian Sea towards the Himalayas from South Africa. But no one ever called their like guru supreme duck. Okay, but that's what it really means. So sorry, supreme duck. But the point is the same one, and that is that there might be a conspiracy here. There's nothing in the story to suggest that they just saw the first creature that they saw. It just so happened to be an elephant. And it just so happened to be, that's a lot better than a flea or a duck. Get it? So there's plenty of nod wink in the story too. And it wants you to wonder about that. Because who would want to be a duck, right? But who among us wouldn't want to be an elephant? Because Indians go, who among us wouldn't want to be an elephant? Elephants are not Disney. They're not stubborn. They're not stupid. They're not anything. They're incredibly royal, smart, powerful, loving. Elephants are badassery with big trunk, are large versions of sweetness in the most, and they're not even honey badgers mess with elephants in the forest. Honey badgers mess with giant water buffalo. Honey badger is a form of Shiva called Sarabeshwara. There's a form of Shiva who turns up in the Ganesha story tomorrow, who's called Sarabeshwara. And he's got the wings of an eagle and the body of a dog and the head of an elephant, and he's got some alligator in him, and he's a little bit of everything. He's like this higgly piggly, and he's the most dangerous, most ferocious, scariest Shiva of the all, and I swear he's the honey badger. Because he looks like a honey badger, and in the forest in India, that is by far the most dangerous creature. Except it's a very sweet creature, because all it either wants to eat you or it wants to leave you alone. Honey badgers go after the big forest buffalo. These are all demons. Like every demon story, sooner or later goes to buffalo, because the buffalo is not only dangerous, the buffalo is unpersuadable. It is impenetrable, right? It's the opposite of an elephant. Elephants learn, and elephants learn from their mistakes. Elephants are really good at not doing the same mistake twice. Brilliant. But what? Because they have memory. Exactly right. But not only because they have memory, it's because they don't rely on certainty and they don't resort only to instinct. So when they can be sure, they try it again. So Appa used to say, if you fall asleep on the elephant when you're going on a journey and the elephant comes to the bridge and the elephant isn't sure it can cross the bridge, it will stop. It won't just keep going. But then it will test the bridge, even if it's been over that bridge before. Because even the things it's certain of, it experiments with. This is vital Ganesha information. Because the only thing more dangerous than ignorance is certainty. Right? And the elephant does not give in to certainty. Certainty is like belief. It's an inhibitor to learning. So the elephant the elephant is certain because the elephant learns. So you're in a kind of paradox. You want to be certain, but if you're really certain, you're putting yourself in more jeopardy. So you want certainty until you don't. Get it? And you want, but the buffalo is always certain. They're impenetrable. There's a famous saying in Tamil. It says, even if Krishna plays his flute, irresistible charm, the water buffalo still chews his cud.
Still chooses what?
His cud, because it's a ruminant. Yeah, yeah. Get it? So he can't, nothing you do can charm him. That's the Lesya problem. That's the hey baby thing. Nothing you can do can persuade him. Nothing you can do can stop him from wanting to be in a fight. Does that make sense? Like, the buffalo turns on you, and he's going to fight. He's never going to run away. He's too stupid to know, run away. Okay? And the honey badger takes advantage of that because he gets behind the buffalo and then does a little damage and then waits for the buffalo to go septic and then kills it. This thing about this big. So it knows. So Brahma, Vishnu, and Indra are tasked to find the head. Except, are they really finding the head? Get it? Like, who's the con on? But the key to the story is that this is a rare moment of Shiva learning a lesson, that he can't put the boy's head back on. Keep going with that. No matter how good a father can't teach the son the fundamental lessons. He can exemplify them. He can get grandpa and uncle and coach to help out. But no son learns the core lessons from their father. Because he's his rival. Now you're back to Freud. He's his rival. They're both in love with the same woman. So fast forward on that. Boys who don't have grandpas and uncles and other good men in their lives, and men who don't have men in their lives like that, are going to have troubled sons. And this may begin to explain the beginning of American society's failure. Because you also have to remember, what does Shiva have to do? He has to ask for help. The indomitable, impenetrable, always right, can't lose the game, Shiva, right? He's got to break into himself enough to go, I need a bro. Like, I need a hand here. Which is not his ordinary nature by a long shot. That's what that whole dice game story was about. So you see, the breakthrough here is again related back to the dice game. He has to break into himself to break himself from his habituation, from his own expectation, to do a better thing. Because if he doesn't, the whole world is going to get worse. So you'll notice that, like, I was on a plane with a bunch of people coming down for spring training, which I thought was pretty interesting. Because, you know, let people entertain themselves the way they like. I thought that's really cool. Men know how to do this and watch the ball, but they don't know how to do this. They're bad at this. They don't, because they're decapitated by their fathers as second wound, right? But as third wound, they don't know how to break themselves. Because you can't, because your bros won't break you. In other words, if you don't learn that there's more in the world, that you have to be made by more than yourself, and that your father can't make you. This is all masculine code. Second wound. Second wound is coming of age wound. First wound is we're born. Second wound is coming of age. In the coming of age, the Ganesha story in origin is a coming of age story, right? So he's going to have to make this rite of passage. And what he's going to find out, of course, is that his father can't fulfill that rite of passage, but he's going to end up functionally capable of dealing with this deformity and this weirdness and this thing that happened to him. Why? Because at second wound, he was given more input. So when teenage boys don't get good input, or when they're abused by one of those three characters, really bad things happen. Because they're going to end up more isolated as grown-ups. And then when they get in isolation, in addiction, or in some form of PTSD, or some form of abuse, and it's not, they could have really good bros. I'm looking around the room, I see Lee and Manny, guys I would think would call me on my shit. Does that make sense? I would expect any one of you to go into me like for manly stuff, right? And the reason that can't work is the reason that can work is if you have already been broken into when you were younger. Get it? You already know that you can't do this by yourself. Because while the boy doesn't know he can't do this by himself, he knows that he's put together by his father, his uncle, his grandpa, and his coach, right? He doesn't know how to do that, but he knows that's what happened, right? And his father, for his part, knows he can't do it by himself. And those other three cats in the story, they know they're all part of a greater story. You leave him all the way to the end, and this is why the Ganesha story isn't this story. You leave him unfixed by the collective effort and unaware of the collective effort, that isolation that happens in later masculine adulthood becomes toxic. Because he can't turn. So you would say, if you're really broken and you have to intervene in another man's life, it's almost impossible. Because the toxicity is the same thing we did in language. It's hardwires. You can't get there. It's hard to break in. Interventions are really hard. Whereas interventions, when there's a piece of you there, right? So, Ganesha. So Ganesha comes out of this remade. We have another question. That poor elephant. Like, where's the rest of him? Yes, but the elephant gets a good deal. Because this is a Hindu world and everything has to go somewhere. So we'll solve two puzzles untold in any text, in any internet version of the Ganesha story origins. That should leave us not unhappy at the end of the first session.
Okay.
Point one, that baby head. Mm-hmm. Now we know that the demon, the baby head, but we can't do it without you. I could have started with the elephant.
Sorry.
No, be sorry. As my mother would say, when you gotta go. So, the baby head. The demon Rahu sees the baby head. Now, Rahu has been decapitated in a previous story from his lower half. But his lower half also survives. And his name is Ketu.
Ketu?
Ketu. Like, it would be Rahu Ketu, which is like a bit like R2-D2. I know. I'm sorry it turns out like that. But Ketu is, and Ketu really does have the personality of 3CPO. Like, it's bad. Sort of like that strange British butler. But Ketu, Rahu wanders the skies as a decapitated head who has tasted the immortal but can't digest it. And Ketu is literally like soaked back into the earth. And he inhabits all the seven talas, the seven underworlds. So in Hindu mythology, there are nine worlds above called lokas. Loka, lucid, lucubration. Hear the word for light there, right? There are nine worlds above and seven planes, talas, seven hells below. And Ketu presides over all seven hells because a piece of him kind of liquefies like a serpent down through this maze. And you're getting a kind of chutes and ladders image. And Ketu is really the chute, right? Because he's really the way down. So, and actually, Rahu Ketu is a version of chutes and ladders, right? So ladders take you up and the chutes take you down, because chutes and ladders is an Indian game. So the other way to think about the Ganesha story is that the dice game is chess and the Ganesha game is chutes and ladders. Indians are always playing both games at the same time. So chess is the game everything has to go somewhere, and the one who's left with the last piece wins. But in the dice game, the one who's left with the last piece loses, because losing is winning, right? When Shiva's left with the extra piece, there's a world, because it doesn't revert to oneness. It doesn't go back to singularity, right? In chutes and ladders, right, you go up the game. You know how you play chutes and ladders? They call it snakes and ladders, right? You go up and like this, and if you get a ladder, you wee right to the top, and you can be playing the game perfectly well and get like right next to winning and get sent all the way to the bottom. Why? Because chess is the game of karma, reap what you sow. Get it? You play the game strategically. Mm-hmm. But chutes and ladders is the game of Leela. Anything can happen at any time for no reason at all, and sometimes you get a boost, and sometimes you get a failure. Sometimes you get a ladder, sometimes you get a chute. So they're always playing karma, Leela at the same time. Karma is, the easiest way to identify karma is everything happens for a reason. When anybody says that, they're just translating karma, 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 karma. That's what they just said. When things can happen for no reason, in no predictable way, that's Leela. Leela happens. When you like it, it's a miracle. When you don't, the other thing happens. And both games are happening at the same time. The third game is that both things are happening at the same time. Ganesha is both things are happening at the same time. So there's all the karma of the Ganesha story. They do this, they do that. It's strategic. They're playing chess to win, right? But there are casualties on the board, like chess. There are casualties on the board. And the head and the elephant are casualties of the board. They're casualties of karma, which is telling you that no matter what, there are casualties of karma Like there's no good solution to this worked out. Like you get what you want, like this ends up okay, like he's swell, he's Ganesha. But every good thing has unintended and unforeseen and unhappy consequences, every single one. There is no karma that doesn't come with missing heads and dead elephants. No matter how good it is. Lila happens, right? So in other words, anything can happen at any time. Shiva's asking for Lila, but he's nodding and winking for karma. Like, take any head. And if it's an elephant, it wouldn't be a bad thing. See how it goes? So he doesn't want Lila to be the sole element. That's why you can posit conspiracy. Because no one wants Lila on its own. You would love, like, what would your, if tomorrow's Wednesday, they pull the lottery on Saturday and Wednesday because it's my retirement program. If it were Tuesday, you only need one thing. You need two things. You need a dollar and tomorrow's newspaper. Get it? So that Lila doesn't happen. Okay. That's what demons do. That's the important part to the next story. That's what demons do. Demons know what they need to trick the world. So the Lila of the story is okay, but what happens to the baby's head? Well, Rahu sees it, but Rahu can't do anything about it because he's just a head. Get it? He can't stop this. But he's got his other half, who is Ketu. So as the head rolls around, Ketu comes up and absorbs it and draws it into the underworld. It sinks through the maze, and it's a chutes and ladders, like it's because like the talas, the underworld isn't like a straight way down. It's this maze. It's a journey. You know, you're looking for the Arne Saknussemm, like it's a long way down. It's a journey to the core. And at the bottom of the underworld is the top of their world. So when demons reach the bottom, that's the top, because everything's upside down. Okay. So, but here's the problem. It's a Hindu world. Everything's got to go somewhere. So now the demons have this thing, which is an elemental form of power, right? It's a piece of the Shakti. It could be more powerful and dangerous. Like, they've got the goods, except here's the problem. You just stole the Hope Diamond. What are you going to do with it? Like, or in my neighborhood, don't steal something you can't fence. Get it? Because it ends up being like nothing but the evidence, right?
Who are you going to sell it
to? Yeah, exactly. Well, we got this thing. So, but they think they've got an ace. Now, there's a lot of different denizens and lords of the underworld. There's Ketu, there's Vasuki, who's the lord of serpents. He's down there. And then there's someone who presides over all of it. And his name is Ayappa. A-Y-Y-A-P-P-A. Ayappa. And he's called Bhutanatha, the lord of the ghosts. This is going to end up, and so the demons, led by Ketu, are going to bring the head of the missing baby to Lord Ayappa. What Ayappa does with this, we will learn after the break. For the elephant's part, notice that the world has a bottom, because it has seven levels on the bottom, and it has a vault, it has a sky. The bottom of the world is the top of the world, right? We already said that. Mm-hmm. So the elephant is on its back, and its four legs are the four pillars of time, and its inside is the vault of the sky. So you're inside the elephant, literally. And that's why Ganesha later on is called Lambodra, the one with the big belly, because where are we? We're all inside Ganesha's belly. And the boundary of the sky, like the boundary, is the inside of the elephant. The elephant's four legs are the four kinds of time. And we're going to need those too. Did we get far enough with Ganesha? Well, we're going to find out who Ayyappa is at the beginning of the next session. And if you miss it, we'll have a recording, so you won't miss anything. And if you bring somebody along who wasn't here the first time, just tell them they didn't miss anything. Was this okay? Did we do all right?
So good.
All right. We need a little prelude to do the fugue. But now we can be full on into Ganesha story. I'll tell some other simple ones, then we get to the really crazy stuff tomorrow. Like, this isn't crazy enough, trust me. I hope you see that it has some bearing on our lives. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Thanks a million for your attention, for your patience with me. It's good.
Isn't K2 the guy, Peter Russell, too? Or no, Peter... Sellers.
Peter Sellers? Yeah, he's Chauncey, too, yeah.
Yeah.
But actually, when you see him as a Murti, like the way to see these stories is to go to the temple, which is why you got to come. Because when we walk through the temple, as I tell you the stories, I'll give you one line, and you'll see the whole story. Because that's what they're doing. But K2, when he does have a top, because he can't just be a decapitated Sleepy Hollow character, which Sleepy Hollow is really the K2 story, right? Like, how does the headless thing live? And the answer is he's a serpent on top. Because he liquefies. Whereas Rahu hardens. So there's two kinds of demon, right? There's the kind that hardens when you're stubborn and implacable and can't be gotten through, and there's the kind that's too liquid. Get it? That's too fluid. That's why compassion can be a demon. Too much, too fluid, and you're not being compassionate, you're being enabling. And serpents are a good thing because they're fluid, but serpents are a dangerous thing if you're too fluid. That's why they teach you not to be. They not only do this, they do this. They show you. That's why the serpents are genius, because they are neither too fluid nor too stiff. That's why they're the third thing. That's why Shiva wears them. That's why they're everywhere. That's why the floor is nothing but serpents. Information is nothing but serpents. It's coherent, but it's fluid. It's stable, but it moves. It can get in anywhere, but only in certain ways. You want my favorite serpent? When the waves, you're ocean people, you live next to the water. Every time the wave touches, every line is a serpent.
Yeah.
Right? And no two lines are ever the same line. But they're all unmistakably the serpent. So they're all themselves, never themselves twice, which is what we are. Because just out of four pieces, like A, C, G's, and T's, no two of us are the same, save for identical twins. Which exactly aren't really the same. Because they're serpents. All the same, but no two the same. So we're the snakes in the story. But we're also, come back, we're also the crows in the story.
Yay!
We're the crows in the story, yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for coming.
I can't stay for the next one.
Another time.
Wonderful.
Oh, good. I'm glad you had a fun time.
I did.
I'm glad you had a fun time.
Thanks, Doug.
Oh, yeah. Hang on, man. Hang on. I'll give you something else, too. No, take that. I got stickers underneath.
Okay.
And these are really fun.
All right.
But check this guy out.
There's an artist out in New Mexico called Kelly Moore, M-O-R-E, who paints many dark birds.
Oh, really?
You might like
I want. What's his name?
He has a website, Kelly Moore.
Okay.
And he's in San Fe, and he does... Dark birds is his special.
Cool.